Hi, Cameron Wilson here for Bush Telegraph today, coming to you from the Dampier Peninsula, which is just north of Broome. We're going to look at what the Aboriginal people here make of the WA Premier's controversial suggestion that remote communities may have to close down. That's coming up soon. And we'll also try to find out how important the communities actually are to the people that live there.
In a big city like that, I found that I was losing a bit of my lian, which is your heart. Your heart, you know, your heart is the one that guides you to your feelings, and we call it lian, you know. And I was losing my bit of pride, you know, in the city where you have to do things to survive, you know. So it's pretty rough, and it's good being back at home in the community.
We've come to Beagle Bay, about 120 kilometres north of Broome, on the Dampier Peninsula, and we're here to visit the Sacred Heart Church. And as soon as you get here, it's a symbol of the missionary history, the missionary past around here, and that European influence. Just going to step inside and look around, because it's known for its mother of pearl altar, and there it is, just to my right, and that is incredible. Turquoise backdrop, whitewashed ceilings, and an altar that is just embedded through the broken mother-of-pearl shell. We've got some shells in their entirety all lined up there as well. I think that might be the school bell we can just hear in the distance. This is such a strong symbol of the European influence around here, and the closest thing I could compare it to, I guess, is Goa in India, where you get that Portuguese influence, and it's just something just that you would not expect to see in this part of Australia. In fact, I can't think of anything in any other part of Australia that I've seen like this. The parish priest here is Father Hilary, who's come all the way from Kenya to make Beagle Bay home. Father Hilary, thanks for having us in your church here. This is a stunning place.
You're most welcome. Welcome to Beagle Bay and to the peninsula, of Dampier Peninsula.
What's the history of this church? Why is it here?
The story of this church goes back to Father McNabb, who came up to the Dampier Peninsula in the eastern side of this country of the Dampierland in 1885. He stayed up here for 5 years and kindly was able to establish a lasting relationship with the indigenous people. And of course, that was the very first time that the people were getting a glimpse of their Christian faith, I could say. Of course, they had their own faith, they had a spiritual connection with God and the land, but this was the very first encounter about the Christian faith.
So Father McNabb was Scottish, but yet this church to me looks like something from the Mediterranean. It doesn't look Scottish.
This church has a lot of things. It has European Christian heritage. And above that, it has also a lot of Aboriginal spirit in the way the church has been inscribed and decorated. If you move around, you'll realize that there is a lot of Aboriginal heart at work. Especially as you look at the altar, you'll realize there'll be a lot of turtles, a lot of fish, different kind of fish, a number of implements and tools that were used by the local indigenous people. And even above it all the brickwork that we have in this church were done by the local Aboriginal boys, men. And this is a church which has over 70% materials locally done and collected by people here. All the shells that we have in the church were done by the women, the ladies of this community, the Nyul Nyul country. So they collected all these shells, had to wash them, they had to bring them to this church. And it must have been an enormous job, a job of love for faith and also for their land, and for their heritage of their children to come.
So that altar that we're looking at now with the broken mother-of-pearl shell embedded in it and right around the windowsills, there's all images, is there, built by, embedded by the local women?
Yes, there are images, actually, on the sanctuary, on the front, especially on the floor of the sanctuary. At little we see them, but when you take a walk through there, you'll see a lot of those images, and you'll be amazed at the way those images were presented there. And this was a way in which people were saying, we are offering to God what was best in this land as a way of thanksgiving to him Why were they so grateful? They were grateful because God had provided them with the bodily nourishment or the physical nourishment. And it was in this way that they were saying, we are laying these decorations of the images of the things that they found in this country as they rise up to the eternal nourishment, the nourishment in the Eucharist, nourishment in the tabernacle that is in front of us.
So Father McNab was here in 1885. Was the church built then or a little later?
No, in 1885, the church was not built yet. The church was built in 1716, 17, and it was completed in 1918 on the feast day of the Assumption of Our Lady on the 15th of August 1918. It was officially opened. And from that day, the church has been used. People have come to worship. People have come to officiate ceremonies. They have come to be baptized here. And even to be given farewell. Those who are dying have also come to celebrate their last moments also in this church.
Mm. So when it was built, it was no longer the Father McNab. So what was it, the French influence then or European?
It was the German Palatine missionaries who came up into this parish in 1900. This was the third group of the missionaries. After Father McNab, we had the French missionaries who came up from 1890 when McNab left this parish. And we have with the French coming up here, and they stayed for 10 years. And after staying for 10 years, because they were monks, they were living a quiet life. So they thought that their lifestyle could not fit the lifestyle of the indigenous people. They wanted somebody who could be more aggressive, who could be more going out to them, not just being in the monastery to pray. Mm-hmm. And that is actually marked the beginning of the coming of the Palatines who came up here in 1900. Of course, the amazing thing is when the Palatine missionaries came up here from 1900, they serviced this mission for 100 years or over 100 years because they stayed here, they made this place their home, and they made a lot of lasting relationships and friendships with people here.
But this is such a long way from anywhere, such a world away from Europe, remote by Australian standards. What was drawing the missionaries here? Why did they come?
There is nowhere which is far from, as long as human beings are there, there'll always be a way that we're connected with other human beings. I mean, I came from Kenya, I didn't know that I'd be here. So I could call Pico Bay a special place, a place of faith, a place of missionaries, a place of, nurturing faith. And then they came actually generally to see the people who were living here. And there was already like, the indigenous people by then was not evangelized, so there was a lot of pressure, there was a lot of belief that there are many, many indigenous people that were living out here that they were yet to receive the faith. That is why they came up here, actually to bring the faith, the word of God.
I'm chatting here with Father Hilary, who's the parish priest of the Sacred Heart Church at Beagle Bay, and look, I've never been in a church like this anywhere in Australia. I've visited plenty of churches, but this just stands out as something totally unique. What did you think when you first walked through the doors here?
Oh, it's just amazing, actually, to see such a building. Even I didn't see one in Africa like this, because this church itself by itself speaks. It speaks volumes. It speaks. It tells us what people were doing, and they were really. It expresses the work of heart. It expresses also a faith of people and a journey which people have lived here. Because when you think about 1900, everything here must have been done using a hand. There were no machines. They were like the way we sing machines outside there. Mm-hmm. So the people were so convinced in what they were doing. And as you are looking at this church, it's actually that kind of conviction that people had. And it's the same conviction that we still have today. And the attachment of this church to the local community here. There is nothing that happens here that the local indigenous people are not aware. They always have a lot of special moments about the church, how they grew up in the mission days, and a lot of relationships about the church. Mm. And they always look up to that. Yeah. It is the biggest thing that has ever happened to their lives.
So it's a real source of pride locally here, is it?
It is, actually. I mean, it is what stands out in the community. Mm. It's what makes Beagle Bay be like Beagle Bay.
It's... It is incredible. It's just such a hard image to describe what's sitting in front of us at the moment, that altar with the Mother of Pearl just embedded. It's just a really stunning image. Do they still talk, do the local community still talk about the people that that worked on the altar and built the church?
With a lot of brides. I mean, most of them, they were their great-grandparents. Some of them were, as young kids, they were told the same stories. And they know for sure who some of the people who were involved in building the church. Some people who are connected with construction work, they are still remember with a lot of fond memories when they first met with the missionaries in the 50s. I mean, most of the people who live in here would be like in the ages of 70, some are the ages of 80. So for sure, they had a direct contact with people who are actually in the actual construction of the church, by all means. So they are still there.
What's Mass like here?
Oh, well, Mass is like any other Mass celebrated elsewhere in the world. We celebrate Mass. We have Masses every morning on the weekdays at 7 o'clock. Every 7 o'clock from Monday to Friday, we have 7 o'clock Mass. And we have people attending Mass. So sometimes people imagine that Pico Bay Church is a place we come and look and go. But yeah, it's a place of worship. It's a vibrant community. On Sundays, we celebrate Masses to the local indigenous people on Sunday at 8 o'clock Mass, and also at 5 o'clock on Saturday. So we always have Masses going on. We have ceremonies, baptisms, we have weddings, we have funerals, we have people, visitors coming, not only to look, also to come and pray, to be connected with their Creator.
Is it all in English or is some of it in local language as well?
Mostly in English, really. I've not spoken the local language yet. Basically, because the Nyul language has not been spoken for a long time by people here. We have, of course, the Nyul language, which was widely spoken here someday, and they're the local honors of this country. We have the Chapa Chapa as you go downwards, and we have the Badi in Charingin and Lombardina, and we have the Achalun as you go up to one end point where you'll be headed to sometimes.
You said we'll learn more about the Jarajan and Adilun very soon. Father Hilary, how do you come to make the trip from Kenya to Beagle Bay?
As a priest, of course, I was ordained to serve and to serve either in the local church and in the universal church. So as a Catholic priest, I will be like ready to go and serve in any community that they call out that there is a need. So it was a time and a moment of need to the Diocese of Broome that I also had to stand up and say, let me come up also to come and serve in this community. I didn't have any idea about what Pico Bay is all about. I didn't know so much about Broome, of course, but I came. I came. It's like you can be sent like the German Palatines. They came in from Germany. It's like the French missionaries who sailed and came up to this world, this place. It's like Father Mark Knapp, who came all the way from Scotland and came to this country. Yeah. So it's the same journey, actually, of a missionary journey. And it's an old story about St. Paul in the gospel, in the readings. He always met missionary journeys to new communities, new people, and when I spread the word. So it's the same spirit also, that I come from Kenya to Pico Bay. It's not surprising.
So you didn't know anything about the area, but what did you think when you first arrived in the community?
Of course, the first thing is, as a priest for a few years that I've been a priest, I mean, at least you get surprised by every culture, every people. I, of course, are supposed to be impressed. Of course, besides the weather, where human beings are, of course, we have to learn. We have to learn the new ways, we have to adjust, we have to speak their language. So, the first thing when I just came, of course, was getting surprised, but of course in the surprise is to make me learn quickly.
But what do you do day to day? What do you do in Beagle Bay?
Heaps of things. Heaps of things to do up here. Meeting people, having conversations of the day-to-day's lives of people, meeting with them in the store, working to their communities, meeting with the students at the school, at the Sacred Heart School. Heaps of things besides other administrative things, like sitting in the office and doing administrative things. There are more interactive things that we do. And most likely among the indigenous people, and also like human relationships is one of the most important things. So we keep the relationship always, every day, there's something new to relate to speak about.
Do you fish? I know there's lots of boats on the way in.
Yeah, fishing is part of life here. So yeah. Once in a while, I go fishing with the local people, and they show me new tricks of getting fish. And yeah, I didn't know how to fish before. I came from a country where we're not fishing so much. But now I do fish, yeah, so that of course I can know to fish men and women to God.
I did notice driving in, though, there does seem a real sense of pride in this community. It's a well-kept, reasonably clean, very clean, in fact, town that it just stands out as you drive in. Do you think there is a strong sense of pride around here?
There is, actually, a lot of that, because in the mission times, most of the people here grew up in the mission days, and they were living in a very organized lifestyle, whereby do you have to make everything like orderly, make your community, your house all clean, make your environment as clean. And of course, we say cleanliness is also next to holiness. So, generally in Big Obey, I think, and in other communities here, they always try as much as possible to make the community clean, which is the best thing anyway. Mm. Yeah, we're happy about that.
As I said, the thing that stood out was how clean and well-kept the town is. But I did notice a couple of signs that referred to either family violence or mental health issues. Are there many problems, many social problems or mental health problems around here?
I would not say specifically, like, I know of, like, more or less mental problems here. Yeah. As it is to the human society and the human communities always have had issues about their social lives. There are always issues with human, so there is nothing that is so particular to Big Obey that I would refer to.
Yeah.
When you talk about social issues, they'll always refer equally to every community in one way or another, either in Big Obey or in a big city or in a small city. Mm. So.
So if we look through the history, we've started off with Father McNab and the Scottish influence. We've got the German, the French.
St. John of God sisters too, who came from Ireland. They were also a big driving force here because they were involved in teaching, especially caring and tending to girls in the mission days. They were also running, caring for them health-wise. They were running a clinic. And they also stayed here for quite a long time. They stayed here from 1900 to just the other day. The last St. John of God sister who stayed here was in the year 2006. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they actually spent a long time with people here and built a lot of relationship, a lot of trust with them.
So this community and this church has brought people from around the world, but has there ever been a local or an indigenous priest here?
At the moment, I could say no. We don't have indigenous priests in Big Obey as such, but of course, in a way, they will always their faith has always been a testimony. Like they have also indigenized their faith. Yeah. So it becomes my obligation to also come and get into their shoes and make things feel like home, feel like in their country. So they've never had a minister from this local community, but I don't think so. It should be one of the things that maybe still stands out in the future.
Yeah, one day,
you never know. Yeah, and it should come.
Now, I don't know what you'll say to this, but I know there's the bells up the back.
Yes.
Can we ring them or not?
The bells that we have at the bell tower always rang before the mass starts. They are actually supposed to be communicating and calling the community and making them aware that there is something sacred that is about to start, so that we could not just make a ring of the bell because it will be like, oh, what is happening? Mm-hmm. So we ring them before we begin our masses. We ring them always to remind people it's all mass times, and those who are attending mass will know what the bell will be all about. So if we just ring a bell now, it may not, the people will just be surprised what is happening, but it will not communicate them to anything. Yeah. But they'll still wonder, why is that bell ringing? Because the bells were supposed to be there to remind them about their faith. They're very exceptional bells too, actually.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so if we want to hear them, we have to come back at 7 a.m.
Maybe 7 a.m. Do you want to come tomorrow?
I would visit this place again and again and again, even if it means arriving at 7 a.m. Look, Father Hilary, thank you so much for telling us the history and your story as well. Been great to chat.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for visiting Bigo Bay, the Sacred Heart Church. It's our pleasure, and God bless you on your journey. Bye-bye.
Okay, I'm with Eddie James, and earlier we heard from Father Hilary about the Beagle Bay Church. This is the Mother of Pearl Church, and Eddie used to go there as a young kid, and his memory and story of the church is quite different to the one we've heard earlier. Eddie, what do you remember of those early days going to Mass?
Well, when we was going to church in the early days, there were so much people in the church, they didn't have much room in the church itself for people to sit in the chairs. People were standing in the doors. There's all doors around the church, and even under the bell, and even outside in the front door of the church, people were standing around.
Why were you going?
Well, I was living in Beagle Bay, and I was going to school there. In the early days, started in 72, 73, and went right through till about 1980, and then I went off to college.
You don't go to church at Beagle Bay anymore?
No, I live at Warren Point at the moment. But I still go to church when there's service on, such as funerals, and probably go to weddings or other things too as well.
What do you see when you look at that Sacred Heart Church?
I see a lot of things. I see a lot of valuable things in there, and see the input that all the older people has put when the church was starting to build in the structure. And the older people way before my time, probably such as 1917 or in the early days such as that, 1918. And it's from the hardship that they put in, is, you know, valuable in from the older ones.
The hardship? Why do you say the hardship?
The hardship into, like, building the church, they had to travel probably about 20, maybe 15 k's out of the major community to collect all the shells of the lugger and bringing it back into Beagle Bay. And probably some of the older people would be making the homemade bricks and things like that.
But were they doing it from their own free will? Were they choosing to do it?
Oh, they were chosen to do it. There was, you know, more into hard times that they couldn't get away from it. It was more locked into, like, prison or something. Not really prison, but they was caught up into these things that they couldn't get away from, and they had to stay till the thing was finished. So that's how they done it.
What, they were taken off their land?
Yeah, they were taken off their land, taken away from family, and told to do all this. So even today, people call it stolen generation, when people was taken away from family and put on the dormitories, such as Beagle Bay, Lumberina, Balgo, and a few other places, such as Geraldton, where people were taken away and put into places. Some was taken away from Balgo, put into Beagle Bay, Turkey Creek, Cardinal, Port Keats, all them places. People were brought to Beagle Bay and put into dormitories. And some other people was put into Balgo and a few other places.
So what, the people that worked on that church put that Mother of Pearl in around the altar, They were taken off their land to do that work?
Yes. Yes, even the other shells that you see on display, it was all going out collecting shells, brought back, put on the walls and all that, and then to build the church, yes.
So how do you feel when you, if you walk into that church, when you look at it, how do you feel?
Probably feel at home when I go down there, so Beagle Bay was like part of my home too as well, so.
But it's such a beautiful church to walk inside. But it sounds like there's a sad story behind it as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of sad stories. A lot of people won't help. There's just for themselves to keep. A lot of people won't talk about the sad times. They talk about the good times. That's what they'll talk about.
I'm going to look at it in a very different way now. Eddie, thank you for telling me your story.
Thank you for having me here. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. And enjoy the rest of your stay here in the area.
On Background Briefing.
Dear world, Ebola has managed to bring my country to a standstill.
It's crippled economies, destroyed communities and families.
I lost 8 family members, including my dad.
So why, despite pleadings, was the Australian government so slow to respond?
If Australia has money available, it should be using that money to mobilise its own emergency response.
Background Briefing, Sunday morning, after the news at 8.
A little further up the road from Beagle Bay is the Ardialoon community at One Arm Point. And if you sit on the bench out the front of the general store, that's a pretty good spot to get a good sense of life in this Aboriginal community. There's a steady stream of people, most come in four-wheel drives, almost all are Indigenous, but there's also the odd tourist that stops by as well. If I look a little further ahead, there's workmen cutting grass and blowing leaves. On the shop message board that's just over my shoulder, there's a notice for the safe house. It's closed for the next couple of weeks. And there's a meeting that's on tonight. It's about the damages of methamphetamine. Just next to those notices, there's a picture of the Senior Citizen of the Year and a warning that a crocodile's been spotted close by. About 300 people live in this community, but despite its size, we're told that there's fear here after WA Premier Colin Barnett warned that some much smaller communities than this, may have to close.
The rate of suicide in the Kimberley is just an absolute tragedy, and there's a number of reasons, again, for that. Lack of employment, or lack of people taking up employment, I should say, is a major issue. I think also in the Kimberley itself, there's over 100 remote, isolated Aboriginal communities. Some of them are quite large, like Balgo and others, and you get social tension, fighting, neglect of children, all sorts of issues that aren't unique to the Kimberley, but they seem to be magnified there. And there's also a large number of very small Aboriginal communities. Some might be 5 people, it might be 20 people. There is no prospect of employment. And one of the issues that we're going to have to face as a state government is trying to have larger, more viable Aboriginal communities and closing some of those small ones. That's going to be a very difficult task to undertake. But I think if we can bring people into viable communities or into some of the regional towns, then they've got a chance of better education, better health, less neglect of children in reality, less domestic violence and a big social improvement. But look, this is an enormous problem. I don't in any sense underestimate the complexity, but it is a social issue that must be challenged.
So that prospect of town closures, small town closures in the years ahead, it's more than just a financial decision, is it? It's also because you believe, or do you believe, that that's socially the necessary thing to do?
Well, it's both, obviously. And the Commonwealth Government has exited the area, so they will no longer fund essential services like power and water in those areas. So the state will do that. It's going to be very, very expensive, tens of millions of dollars to do it. But we won't be able to do it across all those communities. So I with some trepidation, that transformation in the Kimberley over the coming few years is going to be very difficult for people directly affected. It'll also have an impact on the towns in the Kimberley as people move from these remote communities into town. And there are going to be social and crime issues related to that, and alcohol issues and drug issues. That's the sad part of the Kimberley. I am encouraged because I think there are genuinely younger Aboriginal leaders, both men and women, coming through who are now taking responsibility and leading their communities. But these sorts of social changes aren't going to be solved overnight. Mm-hmm.
West Australian Premier Colin Barnett. Well, it was Dean Gooder, Dean's the Chief Executive Officer at the Ardyalloon Community Office, who actually told us about the extent of community concern here since the Premier raised that issue.
The impact is actually immediate after the announcement was, and particularly when it hit social media, and people were concerned and anxious about which community is going to be closed, if community is going to be closed, where people are going to go, and stuff like that. So no Western Australian Aboriginal community should be is immune from these type of things. Even the more successful ones, we all sit back and wait and see what's going to happen with it all. So, as I said, no community would be immune to it in Western Australia because of the uncertainty the announcement by Barnett has made.
But why are people feeling uncertain around here if he's, given that the Premier's been talking about smaller communities, he's said less than 20 people?
Well, he hasn't clarified anything. He's broad statement about closing between 100 to 150 communities is that broad brush statement that affects everyone. And he hasn't given any clear indication how he would assess the economic viability of these communities. And then I don't think he's also taken into account the cost factor and the social impacts on bigger towns where these people would migrate to. You know, I think we'll be looking at probably another fringe dwellers happening on the outskirts of towns like we did in the late 60s.
So what are the people around Ardyalloon, what are they actually saying to you at the moment?
Well, they're saying, what's going to happen? Dean, what's happening? Are we going to be closed? Who's going to be closed? We got no answers for them because I don't think anyone's got any answers, including Barnett.
So how widespread would that fear or concern be around this area? Would it be beyond this community?
Oh, look, I'm saying, as I said earlier, I think it's the whole Western Australian remote Aboriginal communities would be feeling this type of angst and anxiety. And rightfully so, without that, without government actually saying how they're going to assess the viability of these communities. Aboriginal people across Western Australia would insist, if there is an assessment process into the closure of communities, that the assessment also includes a cultural context as well as the economic context for community closures. But to actually be talking about community closures is, at this day and age, is wrong and disgusting, I think. It shouldn't happen in this day and age.
So, Dean, you've talked about cultural context and the need for cultural assessment. What do you mean by that?
Well, Aboriginal people have fought hard and long for their native title rights. A lot of those native title rights have been determined in the Kimberleys. And when we talk in cultural context, that's their traditional lands. And that's where land in this area is where they continue to practice their law ceremonies and their cultural practice, such as hunting, song lines, singing, dancing, and where those practices are still maintained and still practiced, basically. So in the cultural context is that they're on their land, that they've got through determination, and that they are practising their cultural practices and ceremonies.
So what if the culture is strong, tradition is strong, then that needs to be weighed up against the economic cost?
Yeah, not only strong, but things that have happened in the past as well. You know, we've got that strong law and culture right across the Kimberley, and that should be part of the determinant of whether these communities are viable.
If communities were to close, where would the people go?
That's an answer for the government to answer. That's an answer for whether they do, as I said, migrate to the larger towns, and then are those larger towns have the resources to actually address those impacts, and the impacts would be large and wide.
The Premier said that it's not just a financial decision, it's also about addressing some social issues, poor education, poor health, high suicide rates. How serious are those problems around the communities around this part of Western Australia?
Oh, look, they are serious, and we take those things serious. A lot of the communities, all the communities, are trying to address those issues. But again, we need to have a look at the role the Commonwealth and the state governments played in addressing these issues. These issues are just not overnight things. They've been around for lots and lots of years. And in the recent Productivity Committee Commission report on a lot of those stuff just recently, today actually, it was saying that none of those things have improved over these years. So the Commonwealth and the state need to take a lot of the responsibility for those things, for those issues to be increasing. That's not to say that Aboriginal people do understand and are aware of it and are trying to address those issues, but we're trying to do it in a vacuum. We're trying to do it without the support of governments, because government service delivery in the past actually equated to these things festering.
But the Premier seems to be saying that part of the problem is the structure, the community structure, and the fact that there are some such small, remote, poorly serviced communities. Do you think the social issues can be addressed under the current structure, or do you think there does need to be some change?
Oh, look, I think the smaller communities, no one would be arguing against the communities of three or four people and looking at those sort of issues, but the structures on the communities such as ourselves, the communities on the Dampier Peninsula, are relevant to those communities, and that they provide services and programs to all their constituents, if you want. So there may be an issue in regards to the smaller communities, and actually there would be some communities where people are no longer living. But again, we need to take into context the cultural issues as well, and that being people living on their own lands, practising their ceremonies on land that they've won during native title determinations.
What do you think the Premier's motivations are for this announcement?
Look, I think it's, I've seen a few things. I think it's a bit of argy-bargy between the Commonwealth and the state in regards to funding infrastructure for these communities. You know, and really I think Australia had this conversation in 1967 during the referendum. So we're looking at 47 years later on, and the government have still not worked out who funds what. So I really think when the Commonwealth government relinquished the funding and give the state funding, to give the government funding to states to actually carry on these service, the states realised it wasn't enough. They went back to the Commonwealth, and this argy-bargy is happening. And unfortunately, and the reality is that Aboriginal people are the pawns in this whole disgusting funding argument, if you want.
So what will Aboriginal leaders do if this plan proceeds?
I think we need to, Aboriginal leaders, and I think Fitzroy Crossing mob have just come out today and provided a statement. The KLC have provided media statements to it, all condemning the moves, all giving advice to governments that they need to talk to Aboriginal people to work out the process of making these decisions. And if those decisions are to be made, we'd like to look at that being translated to mainstream communities as well. So then it's not just discriminating against Aboriginal communities, it's also being applied to uneconomical, viable mainstream communities who receive their grants from a different area in the Commonwealth Government, particularly through the Commonwealth Grants Commission, who work out formulas for funding based on remoteness, population and stuff like that, and let's put that economic viability in those sort of grant processes.
So be clear, is your argument if you're going to shut the Aboriginal communities, well, look at shutting the small European-based communities that are not financially viable as well?
Well, I'm thinking about, my point is about mainstream, is my point is about if there's an assessment process, and that's what Aboriginal leaders are saying to get Barnett, give us an assessment process where you will, or a criteria to assess the economic viability of Aboriginal communities. We've said that we wanted to have a look at that also in the cultural context, But the assessment of the economic viability, we're saying that that should be then applied to mainstream communities. If they're not economically viable, will they be shut down? If they don't use those processes against the mainstream communities, well, obviously that's discriminatory. That is the simplest form of discrimination. So we'll be looking at, and the leaders have shown that they'll be looking at those sort of things.
Dean Gooder, the Chief Executive at the Ardialoon community. Other Indigenous leaders in this part of the Kimberley tell us something of a different story. They say that most small communities can actually find a way to pay their own way, and many have already essentially closed in recent years or only have occasional residents. We've also heard the view that a mass relocation of people, like that which happened in the 1960s, is actually unlikely. We ask Eddie James if he's worried about community closures. You heard from Eddie earlier. He was talking about the church at Beagle Bay. Eddie lives at One Arm Point at the moment, but he says a much smaller community nearby is actually his home. I caught him on his way into the general store. He was about to go hunting.
I just come to the shop now at the moment to collect fuel cards, get some fuel and go out on the boat hunting for turtles, stingrays or whatever we can catch. Probably bring some food back home for later. So that's the idea of getting food for ourselves.
Just getting ready before you head off for the day, just for the day, the hunt?
Yeah, just for a couple of hours. Yeah. Just go out for a couple of hours, probably you might spend about 4 or 5 hours. All depends on how long we take to catch something.
And what would be a good day, a good catch?
Probably 2 turtles or something like that, or stingray, fat stingray would be a good catch.
A fat stingray?
Yes.
Yeah. And then when you get the turtles, what happens?
We bring them back home and cut them up and share them around with the family or cook them up on the fire and have a good meal of it and store the rest away. If not, just hand them out to other people and share it on.
Yeah. How do you cook them?
Cook them on the open fire or steam it up, fry it up. We can cook them up any way you like, really.
Yeah.
All depends on what you catch. If it's a merry turtle, you cook it up differently. That's the way you go.
What would you prefer to catch, stingray or turtle?
Both.
Yeah.
If stingray is fat now today, I'd rather catch a stingray. Mm. And turtle, just let's leave for somebody else. Have the stingray.
Okay, so you're getting ready to go hunting, maybe catch turtles, maybe stingray. You don't normally live here, do you? Where do you actually live most of the time?
I stay out in a small community called Ngambogan community. That's between Cape Lubic and Lumberina. Probably about 17 to 18 k's out of here. And they drive every day, so in and out of the town. So living out in the bush is a bit quieter, not much rushing around or nothing much to do. Just go out fishing and spend time under the tree or out on the water. It's good.
But what's life like there? Are the houses in the community that you normally live in, are they as new and as well kept as here?
Yeah, you get one new 5-bedroom house with an ensuite. All the rest is just shelters, 1-bedroom sort of shelters. Something for people to live in. But the biggest thing that happened in the community was the general, the biggest house here, 5-bedroom house, so it's really good there. Mm. The only problem we have is the water at the moment.
Is that why you're here? There's no water back at your community?
There's no water back in the community, so we just come stay out in the community where there's everything here. Water, not my problem with water, you get power and all that, so that's all good.
And what do you like about being there? Why would you rather be in that small community than here at One Arm Point?
Well, you can do different things too as well. You can probably walk around, pick yourself a mud crab or go out fishing. Not racing time or making time for things, not planning for anything, just get up and go. Mm-hmm. Do what you want to do.
Different way of life.
Yeah, that's right. You're not rushing for time or anything like that. Just get up and do things.
How many of those smaller communities are around this region?
Probably about over 100. Nearly 100 maybe, or more.
100?
Maybe. Mm. Yeah, so we haven't really got a count of all the communities that's branched off from the major communities that is. So they're going out and done other things, build their own communities. Yeah.
And so what, most of them, what sort of size? How many people?
So could be anything from about 50, maybe 60, could even be more. Some could be lower. Mm. Some might cater for about 100 people maybe. Might be less. It all depends on how the family running and intermarriages come in.
What would happen if those communities were to close?
Want to move back to the major communities from where they branched off. So put in for a house and go back to the major communities, or move back into town, or try to get some funding somehow to continue that way.
And what impact would that have?
A big impact. If they close the major communities or the outer communities, it put people on the spot and they'd wonder, you know, whether they go back to their communities to face another problem or things like that.
How concerned are you that maybe the government, the state government, will close some of those smaller communities?
Well, it is a big concern if the government closes it. You know, where they put all the local people from the communities. If the government's going to close all the fundings and all the communities, where does it put all these people? So they can look for other avenues, I suppose, to cater for themselves or for the community. So,
what would happen to them?
Probably nothing, really. People would still want to live there. They'd find a way to live in the communities and probably try to cater for themselves, I think.
Eddie James, just what will actually happen if small communities do lose funding is quite difficult to determine as you walk around the streets and chat to the people who actually call these places home. But it's clear that everyone seems to value the community and its existence, no matter how big it is or how many people live there. It seems many may have left because of family or study or work, but then they return. Ivan Deer told me what he thinks is so special about the community.
I've been here for just over a year now. I was working at Signet Bay as a chef for the last 3 years, and sort of coming and back and forth between Signet Bay and One Point, catching up with my brother that I never grew up with, and getting back to catching up with family and that, you know.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Broome with my mother and my five sisters. My mum did a terrific job growing us all up. I love my mother, so yeah.
Where did you go from Broome?
From Broome, I left school at 13 and I started working as soon as I left school. Didn't really finish year 9, so I went straight into work, and work took me all over the place. I went to Melbourne, played footy there and worked a bit there, and then I stayed in Darwin with some family up there and seen how the culture and the lifestyle is up there. It was pretty good. And then after that, I stayed in Perth for over 6 years, and that was interesting. Yeah.
How different is it living in a big centre, Perth or Melbourne, versus in the community here?
Well, really, in a big city like that, I found that I was losing a bit of my lian, which is your heart. Your heart, you know, your heart is the one that guides you to your feelings. And we call it lian, you know. And I was losing my bit of pride, you know, in the city, where you have to do things to survive, you know. So it's pretty rough. And it's good being back at home in the community, where you don't have to have money in your pocket just to go down the road, you know, to catch a bus. Or instead of going to the shop to buy a feed, we can just go down to our shop here at the ocean and catch a feed, you know. It's good having that knowledge as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that what drew you back here, was it?
Yeah, that's the main feeling, is that the feeling where you're stuck in a suburb and you can't go and do your traditional things, you know. And it just draws you back home. Yeah, I guess that's what it is.
Yeah, but what are the opportunities here? If you come back and you want to work, you want a family, whatever it might be, what exists here for you?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because the opportunities here, man, since I'm 28 now, and I've worked in a lot of places, and I've always been the only Indigenous person there. And if I wasn't the only Indigenous person, I'd be hearing stories about the last Indigenous person that worked there, and he got his first pay packet and he left. You know, that's what it is. That's what I had to live in. That's what I had to grow up with, was hearing that all my people work and they get their first pay packet and they leave. So it was hard for me, being the only black fellow there, you know, an Indigenous person, and people not exactly knowing where you come from and your background. It was pretty hard, a bit difficult, yeah. Mm. But I never gave up, and I'm still trying because I want to be able to make it opportunity for the next generation of youth to come through. White, black or yellow, doesn't matter, bro.
So what's your future look like here?
My future looks so rich. It's just very rich. And that's the one word that describes everything in this one place. You might have nothing, but you're a rich person when you're here.
So do you have a desire to make sure this culture stays strong and gets passed on to the generation after you?
Yes, I have a strong drive for that exact reason, for that meaning as well, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, a very strong drive for that because of being old enough to say I have a little bit of knowledge now that I can pass on, and instead of just sitting on my hands, you know, I should be able to get out there and actually use it and pass that little bit of knowledge on. And if it's not through culture, through like my big brother is showing me traditional way, I can show them a different way, which is, I don't know, what do you call it, where you in society, you know, in the white man's world, where we can come together, you know.
So it's evolving, the culture here is evolving.
Exactly, and I might be the number one, you know, good little example for that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so for you, did you have to make a choice between pursuing the education or the job opportunities of the city or a big regional centre versus getting in touch with your culture here?
Exactly, bro. That's a good question, because you go into TAFE or you want to go into some sort of study after you finish school, but you don't think that's the right thing for you, because what you've grown up and what you know is a different, total different thing.
How hard is it to walk in these two very different societies?
Oh, I take it as a bit of a challenge. You know, I'm never one to back down for a challenge, and I think it just makes you stronger, you know. And if you stand tall and you believe in what, you know, you stand tall and you believe in what you believe in, you know, it's good.
So you mentioned you came back because of the linga or the
Leon? Yep.
So there was this, obviously, internally there was this something drawing you back, but is there any sense of obligation as well that you have to take on the knowledge?
Really, that's obligations, it's responsibilities as well, and as a man, a black fella who lives in this community, I suppose you do have a responsibility or an obligation to stand tall for what you believe in and to be able to pass it on.
Do you sometimes feel like people think, oh, you haven't stayed at a job, you've moved around, you've gone back home, you're not cut out for this, without realising what the drawback is, the value of coming back here?
Yeah, and that's how strong family is here, because we will always stand by you, you know? Mm. And what you choose is what you choose, and we're family, we'll stand by you for that, you know?
Ivan Dia, who's from the Adelieun community at One Arm Point. Well, thanks to the Bardi people for hosting us, particularly the elders at the Adelieun community. Next week on the program, we look at changes to culture on the Dampier Peninsula, but tomorrow we'll be turning our attention to beef. So make sure you join us then. A big thanks to producer Verica Jokic for today's program. You've been listening to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN.